Before we look at the translation in purport, let's go back and look at the verse itself for a minute. Itamaha samasamye, prasade girisho pamaha, ashraya sarvabhutanam yata devolim ashrayaha. So Pitamaha, Pita is father, Maha is great, so the great father or the grandfather, samasamye, in the matter of being equipoise. So the samaha reminds us of Vijayavinayana. It's hard to call and I can't think properly. Where Krishna says that one who's equipoise with a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater. Pandita samadarshinaha. Samadarshinaha. You see equally. You have a mental equilibrium. Then prasade giripo pamaha. So prasade is, you know, prasadam. And here, Prabhupada says in charity or munificence. In other words, in giving out mercy. And then we have this word girisha. Isha is controller. Giri means mountain. So we often call Krishna Giridhar, one who holds up the mountain. But when you say Girisha, how do we know we're talking about Lord Shiva? I mean, why not Krishna? Why not Indra, who is also on a mountain? But particularly, Giri refers to Mount Kailash. So if you're just going to say the mountain, it means Mount Kailash, and the controller of the mountain would therefore mean Shiva, although there's so many mountains. Then we have Ashrayaha, which Prabhupada translates here as resort. Ashraya also means shelter, resort, where you go for protection. So we have the first line, Pitamaha Samaha Samye. One who is equal, like the grandfather, prasade girishisa. So one who gives prasad like girisha, the controller of the mountain. Then ashraya sarvabhutanam. He'll be the resort or the shelter of all living entities. How? Yata, like deva ramashraya. So deva is a general word for God, but which God? Ramashraya. The God who is the ashraya or the shelter of Rama. So we have Rama and Rama. Rama is the goddess of fortune, who is the shelter of the goddess of fortune. So this is indicating that when you're like the Supreme Lord, who's the shelter of the goddess of fortune, you can be a shelter for all living entities. Okay, translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. This child will be like his grandfather, Yudhisthira or Brahma, in equanimity of mind. He will be munificent, like the Lord of the Kailash Hill, Shiva. And he will be the resort of everyone, like the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayana, who is even the shelter of the Goddess of Fortune. So now in Prabhupada's purport, he's going to have one paragraph each for each of these. So, I mean, if you look at the Sanskrit verse, the first line is to be equipoise like the grandfather. The second line is to be merciful like the Lord of the Hill, like Lord Shiva. And the last two lines are to be the shelter of all living entities like the Lord who's the shelter of Rama. So in this first paragraph, Srila Prabhupada is going to be speaking about mental equanimity. The second paragraph, Prabhupada is going to be talking about mercy. And the third paragraph, Srila Prabhupada is going to be talking about shelter. So before reading this purport, we can think about the fact that these qualities are especially wanted in a leader. Especially Maharaj Prakrit was going to be the emperor. He was the penultimate emperor of the world at the beginning of Kali Yuga. And we may think that, well, these qualities are only important for an emperor, but actually they're qualities that are important for everyone, as we've explained in our other class. Each of us has a little area of control. So these qualities, actually I heard Prabhupada say that the first class where I was with Srila Prabhupada, where I heard him speak in person, Prabhupada was speaking about how each of us is a little Ishwar. Each of us is a little controller. So these qualities are important to us in terms of our area of control. All right, let's read through the purport. First paragraph. Mental equanimity like the grandfather's refers to both Maharaj Yudhisthira and Brahma, the grandfather of all living beings. And of course, that's interesting because Maharaj Yudhisthira is the one who's asking the question. According to Sridhar Swami, the grandfather referred to is Brahma, but according to Vishwanath Chakravarti, the grandfather is Maharaj Yudhisthira himself. But in both cases, the comparison is equally good because both of them are recognized representatives of the Supreme Lord, and thus both of them have to maintain mental equanimity, being engaged in welfare work for the living being. Any responsible executive agent at the top of administration has to tolerate different types of onslaughts from the very persons for whom he works. Brahmaji was criticized even by the gopis, the highest perfectional devotees of the Lord. The gopis were dissatisfied with the work of Brahmaji because Lord Brahma, as creator of this particular universe, created eyelids which obstructed their seeing Lord Krishna. They could not tolerate a moment's blinking of the eyes, for it kept them from seeing their beloved Lord Krishna. So what to speak of others who are naturally very critical of every action of a responsible man? Similarly, Maharaj Yudhisthira had to cross over many difficult situations created by his enemies, and he proved to be the most perfect maintainer of mental equanimity in all critical circumstances. Therefore, the example of both grandfathers for maintaining equanimity of mind is quite fitting. But I'm going to stop after this first paragraph. We'll talk about this, and we'll talk about each paragraph in turn. Before just talking about this paragraph specifically, we said briefly that this verse and purport are important to us because we all have our area of working. We all have our area of control. The subject of my doctoral thesis dissertation was that of job motivation, particularly job motivation of teachers in Hare Krishna schools. But what is it that enables us to find satisfaction in our work? Because here, Maharaj Yudhisthira is inquiring about Maharaj Parikit's work as a kshatriya for the Lord, whether or not he'll be good at it. So the researchers have looked at the fact that there's extrinsic motivators and intrinsic motivators. Extrinsic motivators are how much money you get paid, or do you get paid? Is the place where you work comfortable and clean? Do you have pleasant co-workers? Is it a nice authority system? So forth and so on. And those extrinsic motivators, they can contribute to dissatisfaction, but interestingly enough, they don't contribute to satisfaction. That's something that's really interesting. You know, if your room is cold, then you're dissatisfied. But if your room is comfortable, it's not that you feel satisfied with your job. It just sort of retreats into the background. So there's different understandings of the internal motivations that keep people going, that inspire people in their work. In my research, I was looking at four: responsibility, advancement, recognition, and the work itself. One very famous researcher, Dan Pink, puts it into three: autonomy, mastery, and purpose, which I think those words explain it a little better than the researchers I was looking at, although they're saying the same thing. The nature of the work itself: can you master the work itself? Autonomy or responsibility: how much you have a sense that I'm responsible for this work, that I have some control over how I do it and what I do. And then purpose. Purpose is this something bigger than myself that I'm a part of? Is there something about what I can achieve here? Which again, in my research, we looked at things like advancement and recognition. In other words, does it have meaning? And those are the things that inspire us. So in order to be able to do work that we find inspiring, in order to be able to maintain our autonomy and our sense of purpose, we have to have this mental equilibrium. We have to have this quality of mental equilibrium. Why is it? And Prabhupada goes right to the point. Any responsible executive at the top of administration has to tolerate different types of onslaughts from the very persons for whom he works. So this doesn't just apply to the person at the top. Of course, it especially applies to the person at the top. And we see that a spiritual organization is not immune from this principle. that if people want to find fault in ISKCON, they generally focus their anger and their complaints on the GBC. They don't focus it on the chairman of the GBC, since he changes every year, but they generally focus it on the GBC, or they'll focus it on the temple president. In a family, the children focus their criticisms on the parents. The wife focuses her criticism on the husband, which is my own theory about why Shastra much more emphasizes the wife being faithful to the husband and submissive to the husband than the husband caring for the wife. As the husband caring for the wife is very natural, but a subordinate respecting and submitting to an authority is very difficult for a conditioned soul. So this is our natural tendency. Okay? Prabhupada says here, what to speak of others who are naturally...
The road can be a... stressful place. Download the Road Stress Reliever from 76.com. We're on the driver's side.
Very critical of every action of a responsible man. So as soon as we have any responsibility over others, as soon as our work, as soon as our service we're doing for Krishna puts us in a position of any responsibility over others, we will get criticized. And it's very disturbing to be criticized for the very persons, by the very persons whom you're serving. If you're a teacher, you'll be criticized by your students. If you have a business, you'll be criticized by your customers. It just is what it is. And a person can say, well, you know, I'll work in such a way where I won't have any authority over anyone. Well, then you'll criticize yourself and find fault with yourself. But how can one do the work for which one is destined? How can one do work where one gets a sense of self? When we say autonomy, we mean having a sense that this is where I belong. This is the work that's suited for me, mastery, that I can do this expertly. It's one of the qualities of a devotee, expertly for Krishna, purpose that I'm doing it for Krishna. How can I do the work I'm suited from to a high level of expertise as an offering to Krishna unless I have this equanimity of mind? I can't. Because the vast majority, 99.9999999% of what we do, somebody is the recipient of what we do. Even if you're in the back room washing the pots, you're doing the work for somebody. And the very persons for whom you do the work are the people who are the most likely to find fault with you. And the more you take responsibility, the more people are going to find fault with you. So how does one achieve this mental equanimity? Right, now I remember the verse, Vijayavanaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hasmi Suni Chaivasa Kwaketya Pandita Samadarshina. One has to become a pandit. Or as Krishna explains later in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, how the yogi sees pebbles, gold, and stone as the same, and the more advanced yogi doesn't distinguish between neutral parties, friends, and enemies. As Prabhupada says here, Maharaj Yudhisthira had to cross over many difficult situations created by his enemies, but Yudhisthira is known as a Jati Shastri, that he had no enemies. He was a person, Aja, whose enemies were never even born. They never existed. So this seems very contradictory, because here Maharaj Yudhisthira had many enemies, but no enemy of his was ever born. He never perceived anyone as his enemy. Now, the general tendency is that when people criticize us, that we become very defensive, or we feel hurt. I mean, in fact, I just experienced this yesterday. I had been asked to do a project by some devotees, and they were very happy with the project I did, but they had some criticism of my dealings with them. And they said some very hurtful things. So, you know, after I got off the phone, I was feeling very hurt. Well, how can people say these things about me? I tried my best. Why didn't they tell me this as we were going on? Why did they wait to the end to say this? And anyway, I wasn't really like this. It wasn't really fair. Really, they were the ones who were like this. It wasn't me that was bad. They were bad. Something. So we may feel very hurt when we're criticized. Or we may go on the defense. You know, we may attack the other person, say how we're actually wonderful. And we might not just think it. We might say it. Or we might act on it. Or we might do something to take the other person down. Or we might envy them and think, why do they have the position to criticize me? Why can't I be in the position? There's so many things. So if we have that mood, then there's no question of focusing on our service. We can't focus on being where we need to be, doing what we need to do to a high level of expertise and offering it to Krishna. We become distracted. So one gets this mental equanimity by actually being a pandit and a yogi. By knowing yagyartart karmano natra lokoyam karmabandana tadartam karmakantaya mukti sangha samachara. By knowing that our master is Krishna. Our master is not really Brahma. Our master is not the public. Our master is Krishna. We're looking for Krishna's pleasure. Therefore, the pleasure or displeasure of the people for whom we are serving cannot be what gives us our impetus or takes away our impetus. As soon as we're affected, as soon as we feel discouraged or encouraged by the praise and blame of the people for whom we are serving, then we cannot have equanimity of mind and we cannot find the satisfaction in our life that we're seeking. It will be a distraction. Actually, the whole material world is set up kind of as a distraction. And this criticism of the people at the top, we can remember, it comes because ichidvesha, we're all born in with this ichidvesha, this desire and hatred. And therefore, every living entity is desiring to be God and hating God. Therefore, anyone who represents God in their lives, they will hate. Because everyone is thinking, if only God would be my servant, if only God would cooperate with me and do what I want, then I would be happy. So anyone who represents God, whether it's the president, the king, the boss, the husband, the parents, the police officer, the GBC, the temple president, the guru, we put our anger on that person. Put our frustration on that person. We blame that person for our situation. If only that person acted differently, then I would not be suffering. So understanding that that's the mentality of all conditioned souls, we can realize that person's criticism of us is really a criticism of Krishna if we're acting as Krishna's agent. And I can understand that my criticism of my authorities is really coming from my envy of Krishna. Therefore, one doesn't take anything personally. And one can have equanimity of mind. One can understand, oh, these people are criticizing me simply because that is the nature. Prabhupada says here, naturally, it is the nature of conditioned souls to be very critical of anyone who takes responsibility. It's just part of the mentality of a conditioned soul. Therefore, it's not really directed at me, it's really directed at Krishna. And I can be equipoised. Of course, one should listen carefully to the criticisms of others if those criticisms are useful and constructive, but not take them personally, not think, oh, this person, ultimately this means I'm a bad or an evil person. Another way that one can have equanimity of mind is, in fact, by doing just that, thinking that these so-called criticizers and so-called enemies are really sent by Krishna to teach me some sort of lesson. Maybe they're to teach me some lesson about how I can change my behavior or my attitude. but I'm meant to learn something from them. At the very least, I'm meant to learn that although I am a representative of Krishna, I am not Krishna. I am not perfect. I cannot be everyone's friend. I cannot be, as we'll get to the last paragraph, everyone's shelter in any sort of ultimate sense. I am at best only a fallible soldier. And remember, I'm just a tiny living entity. And this way, one can also be equipoised, seeing that the friends that Krishna sends to us to encourage us, and the so-called enemies, so-called friends, so-called enemies that Krishna sends to disparage us, are both simply to keep us more fixed to the truth. They are both sent by Krishna. Nobody can, Mare Krishna, Rake Ke, Rake Krishna, Mare Ke, nobody can do anything to us without Krishna's sanction. And therefore, they are both a manifestation of love. Okay, let's go on to the second paragraph, which this is dealing with the second verse, second line of the verse, prasade girish o pamaha. That they will give prasad, give mercy, give charity, like girisha. Lord Shiva, this is a purport. Lord Shiva is a demigod celebrated for awarding gifts to beggars. His name is therefore Ashutosha, a one who is pleased very easily. He is also called the Bhutanata, or the Lord of the Common Folk, who are mainly attached to him because of his munificent gifts, even without consideration of the after effects. Ravana was very attached to Lord Shiva, and by easily pleasing him, Ravana became so powerful that he wanted to challenge the authority of Lord Rama. Of course, Ravana was never helped by Lord Shiva when he fought with Rama, the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the Lord of Lord Shiva. To Vrikasura, Lord Shiva awarded a benediction which was not only awkward but also disturbing. Vrikasura became empowered by the grace of Lord Shiva to vanish anyone's head simply by touching it. So, of course, his first cantos were originally written by Srila Prabhupada in India, and obviously the editors were loath to mess with the language too much. But this is interesting English construction, to vanish anyone's head simply by touching it. Although this was awarded by Lord Shiva, the cunning fellow wanted to make an experiment of the power by touching the head of Lord Shiva. Thus, the Lord had to take shelter of Vishnu to save himself from trouble. And the Lord Vishnu, by his illusory potency, asked Vrikasura to make an experiment with his own head. The fellow did it and was finished himself, and so the world was saved from all sorts of trouble by such a cunning beggar of the demigods. The excellent point is that Lord Shiva never denies anyone any sort of gift. He is therefore the most generous, although sometimes some kind of a mistake is made. So here Lord Shiva is considered the epitome or the personification of generosity, because he gives anything anybody asks him for. And you might say, well, gosh, what am I worshiping Krishna for? You know, I just go to Lord Shiva. But the problem is that Lord Shiva is almost generous to a fault, we say. We have this expression, generous to a fault. And two examples are given here, that Shiva was very generous to Ravana, and Ravana caused so much trouble that Lord Ramachandra had to defeat him. And he was generous to Vrikasura, so much so that Vrikasura then wanted to kill Lord Shiva. And again, Lord Vishnu had to intervene and save, as Prabhupada says, or the Lord Vishnu, and he had to save Lord Shiva. But this level of generosity is also, with some discrimination, needs to be there in anybody who has some responsibility. We talked about this last time, the concept that in my area of responsibility, I am not an exploiter but a giver. That the people, whoever, whatever people I am responsible for, it's not that those people are meant to serve me, it's that I'm meant to serve them. You know, my wife does not exist to cook for me and clean for me and tell me what a great hero I am. Rather, she exists as someone I'm supposed to cherish and someone I'm supposed to protect and someone I'm supposed to engage in Krishna's service and give her gifts, not necessarily or only of saris and jewelry, as prescribed in the Shastra, but I'm supposed to give her the gift of Krishna consciousness, like Kardama Muni gave to his wife. Right? My children are not there just so that I can have a bumper sticker saying my child is an honor student, and so that, you know, I can watch them get up on stage and everybody looks at me and says, oh, what a wonderful mother or father you are. My children are there so that I can be generous with my time and my energy and my money and give them all facility for a happy material life and advancement in Krishna consciousness. Even with the objects that I'm taking care of, even with the non-living entities that are under my care, I am meant to use those objects, those material things in Krishna's service. I'm not meant to have to exploit those objects of the material energy and use them for my own sense gratification. That is because ultimately I am a giver. I am a servant. You know, we have the word servant. In the first Russian translations of Prabhupada's books, the word das was translated as slave rather than a servant. In modern society, we may not like the word servant very much. We've tried to eliminate all the servant from our society and just have mechanical servants. So we can say a giver, or someone whose pleasure is vicarious. The nature of the living entity is to have vicarious pleasure rather than direct pleasure. Exactly like the hand is meant to have pleasure by facilitating the eating and the breathing of the stomach and the lungs. The hand doesn't eat and breathe directly, indirectly. So the living entity function is to unite Krishna and his pleasure energy, to unite Sita and Ram, Radha and Krishna. They are the enjoyer, to facilitate their enjoyment, and then vicariously I enjoy. That is my natural position, which of course we see in this material world. Why do we like to go to weddings? You know, we're taking vicarious pleasure in the love of the bride and the groom. Why do we like to give service to others? We talked about this the other day also. Why do I get more pleasure doing something for someone else that actually gives them pleasure? Not doing something for someone else that's not appreciated. But when I act as a catalyst of pleasure for somebody else, I get much more satisfaction than if I give that same pleasure directly to myself. And we could say that even if they don't know that I'm the catalyst, it's still very pleasurable. Now, if I arrange for someone else's happiness and they don't even know that I'm the one who arranged it, but they become very happy, that gives me great happiness. So that is an indicator of my natural dharma, my natural function. So in whatever area one has control, to whatever people one is responsible, one should be a giver. Of course, there's a little caveat here that one should not just give indiscriminately. You don't want to give your children just anything they ask for, anytime they ask for it, any way they ask for it, or they will become spoiled. So Lord Shiva has this sort of tendency. You could say Lord Shiva is the Lord. Lord Shiva is almost like Krishna. He's the Lord in this mood of an indiscriminate giver. Lord Shiva and his wife Uma, they are the mother and father of the material world. And if we want to know why we suffer here so much, it's because here the Lord is in the mood of an indiscriminate giver. Of course, in Vaikuntha, the Lord is also in the mood of an indiscriminate giver. But there, Kalpaviksha Lakshabrasetu, whatever you want, you can have. But the residents of Vaikuntha know what you want, whereas the residents of the spiritual, of the material world, rather, don't know what you want. They don't know what you desire. So if you come under the shelter of Lord Vishnu in this world, Lord Vishnu is not an indiscriminate giver in this world. Lord Vishnu is an indiscriminate giver in Vaikuntha, in Goloka Vrindavan. In this world, if you want to deal with the Lord as an indiscriminate giver, you have to go to Lord Shiva. But the problem then, if that's what you want, is that a lot of what you get may cause you suffering. That you may end up under the trident of Lord Shiva's wife, who Prabhupada says is not an ordinary mother. She rides on a tigress, and she pierces one with the threefold miseries. So if one wants to get one's desires fulfilled indiscriminately in this world, then one will also have to suffer. And that is not the fault of Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva is not faulted for being just generous. So in the same way the king is meant to be generous, but is meant to be generous, more like Lord Vishnu. Now, how do we know that? Because we go down to the last paragraph of the purport. Rama means the goddess of fortune, and her shelter is Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu is the maintainer of all living beings. There are innumerable living beings, not only on the surface of this planet, but also in all other hundreds of thousands of planets. All of them are provided with all necessities of life for the progressive march toward the end of self-realization. But on the path of sense gratification, they are put into difficulty by the agency of Maya, the illusory energy, and so travel the path of a false plan of economic development. Such economic development is never successful because it is illusory. These men are always after the mercy of the illusory goddess of fortune, but they do not know that the goddess of fortune can live only under the protection of Vishnu. Without Vishnu, the goddess of fortune is an illusion. We should therefore seek the protection of Vishnu instead of directly seeking the protection of the goddess of fortune. Only Vishnu and the devotees of Vishnu can give protection to all. And because Maharaj Parikshit was himself protected by Vishnu, it was quite possible for him to give protection to all who wanted to live under his rule. So here we see that although one should be generous like Lord Shiva, really one should have discriminatory generosity and shelter like Lord Vishnu. So we read here that Prabhupada's saying that everything needed for self-realization, the Lord will provide. Whatever necessities of life one needs to become self-realized. So this means basic physical necessities, mental, emotional, social necessities. And it also means whatever lessons are necessary, which of course the conditioned souls may take as unpleasant, just as most children would rather play than go to school. And when one accepts these necessities for self-realization under the protection of Vishnu, then one gets the shelter of Rama, the genuine goddess of fortune. If one, however, goes to Lord Shiva to try to get the, or goes directly to Durga, his wife, in order to get so-called economic development, false plan, Prabhupada says here. How many times does he use the word illusory? Says, let's see. Illusory energy, 1, 2, 3. We count the word illusion 4 times in this paragraph. So you don't get fortune if you try to go to Shiva and Durga, who will give you indiscriminately what you want. You just get pierced. That's not fortune. You get repeated birth and death. Right? One simply gets a series of illusory bodies with illusory wealth. Nothing, there's nothing that's substantial. Nothing that actually touches the heart. Nothing that brings us to the happiness that we desire. So in our area of control, our area of responsibility, we're meant to be generous like Lord Shiva, but as an agent of Lord Vishnu. How can one be an agent of Lord Vishnu? One has to be under the protection of Lord Vishnu. Actually, no jiva, not even Maharaj Parikshit, is able to give shelter and protection to anyone. It's not possible. Prahlad Maharaj makes this point. A boat cannot save a drowning man. A physician cannot heal the patient. Parents cannot protect their children. I mean, we've all experienced it, that the people under our care that we try to protect, we're not always successful. The objects under our care that we're meant to take care of, we're not always successful. They may get broken, they may get stolen, they may get damaged. The people we're taking care of, they may become bewildered and distracted, or they may become physically hurt, they may become spiritually hurt, mentally, emotionally, socially, spiritually. Despite our best efforts, we're not ultimately the protector. So what does it mean that Maharaj could give complete protection? Really, it's because he's protected by Vishnu. Taking shelter of him is taking shelter of Vishnu, who can protect everyone. And in his arms, his actual fortune is actually Rama, is actually Radharani. And we have to look at this very carefully. Krishna should be our only shelter. This is actually the definition of prem that Rupa Goswami gives, quoting Bhishma Dev, that all feelings of kinship are reposed in the Lord. We have no other shelter. Kunti talks about this also. As the Ganges flows to the sea, let me take shelter only of you. She says, break these false shelters of my family attachment, thinking my family is my shelter, these fallible soldiers. Only Krishna. But why do we say also take shelter of the devotee? Interesting, in the aspect of rasa, vaibhav. Vaibhav is divided into ashraya and udipant, shelter and impetuses. And ashraya is divided again into two, the object and the repository of love. Krishna is our object of love, and the devotee, especially the supreme devotee, Srimati Radharani here, who is represented as Rama, the goddess of fortune, is the shelter of that love. Prabhupada uses the English terms the lover and the beloved. The lover is the one who is loving, the beloved is the object of love. So Krishna is the only object of love, but in order to fully take shelter of Krishna, one also has to be under the shelter of the lover of Krishna. However, as soon as one takes shelter of the lover of Krishna independently, then everything becomes illusory. And this is true even at the level of Srimati Radharani. So here Prabhupada's talking at the level of Lakshmi. But it's also true for Srimati Radharani. One does not take shelter of Radharani separate from Krishna. You might say, wait a minute, Lila, what about some of the Manjari gopis, like Rati Manjari, who appears as Raghunath Das Goswami, who says, I am a servant of Radharani and I love Krishna only because he's dear to Radharani. The focus of some of the gopis is certainly on Radharani rather than on Krishna, but their object is to bring Krishna to Radharani. Their object is not Radharani separate from Krishna. They don't want Radharani separate from Krishna. They want Radha Krishna. Now, whether those on high level of realization are thinking, I want to bring Radha to Krishna, or whether they're thinking, I want to bring Krishna to Radha, according to their particular bhav, still, the mood is Radha and Krishna together. So we are advised to meditate on the lotus feet of Krishna, or on Radha Krishna, who is also Mahaprabhu, if you want a very simple way of meditating on Radha and Krishna. We can meditate on Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So this is true for the top devotees, Srimati Radharani, Lakshmi Devi, Rama. This is also true for any other devotee. This is true for one's guru, who was a representative of Srimati Radharani or a representative of Lord Nityananda. That if one thinks that my guru independently can save me, the whole situation becomes an illusion. Guru Krishna Prasade Paya Bhakti Lata Bija. Right. What is that verse? I have a bad cold and my head's all filled up with, I can't think. Second to last verse in the Sukshastika. Shaksha Dharitvena Samasta Shastir Uktastataba Vyakta Eva Sabhir Kintu Prabhurya Priya Eva Tasya Vande Roshi Charanaravinda. Sakshad Haritvena. Sakshad Hari. We may see that the Guru is Sakshad Hari. He is Krishna. Right? There's the mantra Guru Rama, Guru Vishnu, Guru Shiva. Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. But it's not Sakshat Hari, it's Sakshat Hari Tvena. So we see, and Kintu Prabhurya Priya Evatasya, because he's very dear to the Lord. So if someone's taking shelter of Krishna, taking shelter of them is as good as taking shelter of Krishna directly. In fact, one can only take shelter of Krishna directly by taking shelter of the devotee. One has to have both. both things are in Vaibhav. One has to have Krishna as the lovable object under the shelter of the devotee. But the point is that one is not independent of the other. One cannot take shelter of Krishna independent of his devotees, and one cannot take shelter of Krishna's devotees independently of Krishna. As soon as one does that, then it is illusory. And this is also the main principle about why we don't take shelter of the demigods directly. So there are demigods who are pure devotees, like Lord Shiva, like Lord Brahma. But if as soon as you, like Ganesh, but as soon as one takes shelter of these demigods independently, everything becomes an illusion. If we take shelter of them as Vaishnavas, and then everything is rightfully done. And many of these demigods, like Lord Shiva, he's the founder of a Sampradaya. Lord Brahma is the founder of a Sampradaya. He's also our Pitamaha. One should be very careful like that. Because if one takes shelter of a devotee separate from Krishna, it's an illusion and one will suffer. Exactly like if you try to take shelter of Radharani separate from Krishna, well, then it's not Radharani anymore. Durga.
The road can be a stressful place. Download the Road Stress Reliever from 76.com. We're on the driver's side.
Try to take shelter of Lakshmi without Narayan, you get Durga. But don't try to take shelter of the devotee separate from Krishna. Then it will simply be suffering. And then you'll say, all these devotees are no good. Krishna consciousness is no good. For ourselves as shelter givers, we give other people Krishna's shelter. We don't give them our shelter. And that's what was explained here with Maharaj Parikshit. He could shelter everyone because he could give them the shelter of Lord Vishnu. Like it says, Suridam Sarva Bhutanam, Krishna is the friend of all living entity, and the devotee is supposed to be also Suridam Sarva Dehinam, which is also, of course, very nice to explain to you with Maharaj Parikshit, Ashraya Sarva Bhutanam. But Prabhupada says, if a guru says, I am the friend of everyone, then he's a rascal. How can I be the friend of everyone? I am the friend of everyone if I give you to your friend. So let's say, there are sometimes stories like this, a person is separated from their beloved friend or their lover, their husband, their mother, their father for a long time. And if you're the one who arranges a meeting between them, you become also the best friend. If I help someone to find, you know, and they got separated by war, whatever, and I help the woman to find her husband, I'm the best friend because I united her with the best friend. So like that. I'm not the best friend independently. So here we see three very important qualities for becoming a fit agent of the Lord in our sphere of influence and for coming to experience the satisfaction that we want from anything we do. The satisfaction that what I'm doing is what's right for me, that I can become expert in my work, and that what I'm doing is devoted to Krishna. It's part of something bigger than myself. In order to do that, I must have equanimity of mind, because I will be criticized. There's no doubt about it. And I'll be criticized by the very people whom I want to give me recognition and give me appreciation and consideration. The people who I'm serving, the people who I'm protecting, they are the ones who are the most likely to criticize me. The next point is to be a giver. To be a giver almost to a fault, not an exploiter. And the last point is to realize that I am not the doer, I am not the friend, I am not the protector, I am not the controller. Krishna is. And whatever protection and giving and care that I can do, whether for other living beings or for objects or for both, are only insofar as I am under Krishna's protection. As soon as I proclaim myself an independent protector, then I create an illusion both for myself and for anybody who's under my shelter. So I damage myself and I damage them. And then looking up at our protectors, we can remember that we need to, what we say, cut them some slack to curb this natural tendency to criticize anyone who has power over us. When we see people over us who are generous in their giving, even if they make some mistake in their giving, to remember that even Lord Shiva sometimes makes some kind of mistake, as Prabhupada puts it. And not to be too critical. Oh, why are they giving? Why are they so generous? And to remember also with our authorities, never to think that anyone is independent of Krishna. That when we take shelter of the devotee of Krishna all the way up to the supreme devotee, Srimati Radharani, we do so in combination as part of our taking shelter of Krishna, never separately, with Krishna as the only object of shelter. And when Krishna is the only object of shelter, his devotee, taking shelter of his devotees is included in that rather than being separate from that. So in this way, we can examine to what extent, just like Maharaj Yudhisthira wanted to know, here is just Maharaj Parikshit being born, but he wanted to know in advance whether or not Maharaj Parikshit was a fit candidate for training. So he wanted to know whether or not he had these qualities. So we can also look at ourselves. To what extent do I have these qualities? To what extent am I equal in mind? To what extent am I a giver? To what extent am I under the real shelter and giving the real shelter? And therefore we can judge our own advancement. We have a gauge. To what extent am I really absorbing myself in the process of spiritual life? And if we see lackings in these areas, then not to lament the symptoms and try to fix the symptoms independently, but to work on the root cause. The root cause, that I have to become actually a deeply spiritually qualified person, especially in my main processes of hearing, chanting, and remembering. So we can have a little question-answer discussion.
I guess we're already admitted. Lovely class, Mataji. Let me see. I'd like to ask, you were talking really eloquently about criticizing and how we should see criticism that comes to us in many different ways, particularly see the criticizers as an agent of Krishna and accept that for our own purification. How do we walk very carefully the dangerous line of giving criticism, hopefully constructive, when we're in a situation where we have to correct devotees and sort of put them in their place and bring them back into the fold without falling prey to our false ego overtaking and making that impure?
Well, I would start off with the realization that it's going to be the natural tendency of a conditioned soul to criticize anybody who I perceive as a gatekeeper for my sense gratification. And that I will, if I'm trying to be a devotee, I will often call my sense gratification service. I'm not going to be upfront that what I'm looking for is sense gratification, subtle or gross. I'll say it's my service. So anybody that I see who's guarding the way to something that I want, whether I consider that thing that I want is sense gratification or whether that thing that I want is service, they're not allowing me to do my service very well, that my tendency is going to be to criticize it. Prabhupada talks here about the gopi. You know, their service was to look at Krishna because he got very happy when they looked at it. It's like you feel happy when someone admires how attractive you are. So the gopis admire Krishna's attractiveness to bring him pleasure, but they couldn't do it fully because they had to blink So they were criticizing Lord Brahma for impeding their service. So for to remember that this tendency is going to be there. Of course, when the gopis do it, it's loving. They're not envious of Brahma. They're not really critical of Brahma. It's a loving exchange. But for us as conditioned souls, it's going to tend to be envious. So most likely, unless I'm swimming in an ocean of ecstasy, diving and surfacing at every moment, that means I have some envy. So most likely, my criticism of people has some envy in me. Some proportion of envy. Some proportion of, I want to put this other person down, get them out of the way, like the demons. So this person's my enemy, he's been killed, and any other enemies that come my way, I'm also going to kill them. So we don't generally literally kill people, but we try to destroy their, we try to get them out of the way. Try to remove their power and their influence. So the first thing is honesty. And to what extent is that what's motivating me? Because probably a lot. Probably a lot more than we think. And that's a manifestation of our original envy of Krishna. So first look at that and deal with it. And if the majority of our reason for criticizing is simply because I'm seeing that this person is an impediment to what I want to do, we should probably just stop and let it go. Our valid reasons for criticizing someone could be if that person is someone over whom we have some authority, some relationship with them, we have some responsibility, and that person is doing something that is going to damage themselves, unrelated to any harm to ourselves. So if a child's playing with a knife, you know, if the student is not getting their work done, if you have somebody, you're responsible for their well-being, they're doing something that's harming themselves, and your own happiness or distress is not contingent upon their behavior, that's a good reason to criticize. In fact, one must criticize in such situations. Another reason to criticize is when you see, again, you have some position of responsibility or authority, and you see that people in general are going to be hurt by the behavior that's going on. We can look at the austerities of speech. So the austerities of speech given in the Bhagavad Gita are pleasing, not agitating to others, truthful, beneficial, and regularly reciting the Vedas. Pleasing means that the message itself is pleasing. So if the message itself has to be pleasing, you'd never be able to criticize. Not agitating to others means that the words themselves are not agitating to others. So if you say to somebody, you're irresponsible, or you're difficult to work with, you're lazy, that's agitating to others. Or using curse words, using low-grade language, or even emotionally manipulative words. Well, this is obvious. I mean, can't you see it? It's obvious. Someone did that to me the other day. At least it was somebody who I could say, hey, stop using emotionally manipulative words. So that's not agitating to others. I mean, you know, sometimes somebody talks to you, and when you finish talking to them, you feel agitated. That's what happened when I got off the phone with this person yesterday. This person spoke to me in a very put-downish way. And for several hours after I got off the phone, I felt physically disturbed. So not agitating to others. Then truthful. We should speak something that's true. So I've been having an email conversation back and forth with a devotee who feels that he's the protector of ISKCON, and he has a website where he posts critical things about leaders of ISKCON. And I pointed out to him that some of the things he's saying are not true. They're just out-and-out lies. And he says, well, I try to check my sources. Well, how did you try to check this? Because I know it's a lie. Obviously, he didn't. But he doesn't take it down. And I said, really, Prabhu, if you want to post something critical, you better know for sure it's true. And he said, well, I can never know for sure it's true. Well, then maybe don't post anything. So you know, be sure that it's true. Then, based on the Vedas, not just based on our own concoction. You know, there was a big discussion on Dandavats about my giving class in Mayapur, and some of the people commenting were making up their own systems of religion. Dharman Tushakshad Bhagavat Pranit. Dharma comes from God. They were just making up rules. They'd say, well, women can only preach to other women, or only if her husband is also a preacher, and if he's sick that day. But none of that's in the Shastra. They're just making that up. So make sure that whatever fault we point out is an actual fault, not just something that we're creating from the sky. And the one I'm going to say last is beneficial. Mm-hmm. So to make sure that whatever we say is actually going to benefit that person. Not in theory. Not that it has the potential to benefit the person, or it could benefit the person if they would only listen, but that it actually will benefit the person. Of course, you can't say 100%, but this is related to the offense of preaching to the faithless. Beneficial means that the person is open to what you're going to say, and that you have a relationship with them. First of all, that you have a relationship with them where they're likely to trust you, and second of all, that they're at a level of advancement where they're going to be open to hearing what you have to say. You're not saying something beyond their level of maturity to accept. This principle doesn't just apply to talking about Rasa Leela to meat eaters. It doesn't just apply to that. It applies to giving anyone an instruction that they're not mature enough to assimilate. You know, you speak the truth to a fool, they become angry. And a person's ability to assimilate something depends on the content of the message and the relationship of the message giver. I'm sure we've all experienced that a person won't listen to something from me, but they'll listen to somebody else saying the same thing. And you think, well, wait a minute, I just said that. How come they took it from this person and not from me? Because it was a different relationship. And we have that experience ourselves. There are certain, I have certain people in my life who can tell me some really heavy things. Really heavy thing, who can just say, Urmila, you have this problem. And I don't become disturbed. Because I have a relationship with that person that I trust. That first of all, that they're telling me the truth, and that I trust that they're telling me the truth because they care about me, not because it's going to give them some kind of benefit. So all those things have to be there. Now, of all of them, the one you have to jettison in order to criticize is pleasing. Because the content of criticism, by definition, is not pleasing. However, if everything else is there, criticism can actually be pleasing. It can be refreshing. Because I think all of us, at some level, want to know how to improve. We have a place where we genuinely want to know how we can do better. I mean, maybe there's some person who doesn't think that way, but I haven't met. And it can be pleasing to hear correction and to hear criticism, but all those other things had better be in place. The language has to be non-agitating. The language has to be kind. The language has to be not accusatory, blaming, name-calling, directly or indirectly. You know, what I had someone say to me yesterday was, well, other people said this about you and I didn't believe it, but now I know it's true. Whoa. That was agitating. What we say has to be truthful. We better know it's truthful. We better make sure it's truthful. It's got to be truthful according to the Vedas, not that we've made something up. And we have to have the motive and the relationship where we can really benefit the other party. And if we're speaking without a mood of actual benefit, then we're committing an offense to the holy name, and we really have to examine then what are our motives. Am I trying to correct this person just because I want to get something for myself? I want to get some gross sense gratification, some subtle sense gratification that I'm better than they are. I want to get some facility for my service that I think this person is controlling. You know, it's about me. It's not about them. I'm not thinking about their benefit. I'm not thinking I'm going to help them. It's about me. So if we apply these criteria, most of the time we're not going to say anything, which will be a very good thing, because then we're not going to risk committing the first offense on Channing, and then we're going to skyrocket to the locum and done.
Wonderful answer. Thank you.
Mother Irma, I have a question, but I'm almost afraid to ask it just because I know you're not feeling well. Do you want to take another question?
Yeah, I'll try. Just my voice is a little funny because my nose is all plugged up and my throat is hoarse. Go ahead.
By the way, that was a wonderful answer. As far as tolerance and equanimity of mind, you know, and accepting it, it's like Krishna's sending the person to, you know, help you advance in Krishna consciousness. There's many inspiring things that we read in the Shastras, you know, about Haridas Thakur being beaten all the marketplaces and Durga getting thrown out, you know, by his good advice by Duryodhana, etc. But I mean, philosophically or theoretically, we can understand these things, but when, so to speak, the rubber meets the road and we're actually in a situation where, you know, we're being chastised or whatever, or criticized by those who we respect and or we care about, that's a kind of a whole different story.
Well, those are the very people who are going to criticize you according to the first word.
Right. So, when you just gave the example that you yourself, you know, you get criticized and you feel hurt, what hope do we have not to experience the same? I mean, how do you...
Well, first of all, I don't know you want to put me up there, but let's put Judd Barrett up there. Judd Barrett was a self-realized soul. And it said that he felt waves of mental dissatisfaction when Maharaj Rahuvana insulted him. And what to speak of Judd Barrett, it's explained that Lord Varaha was pained by the abusive words of the demon Hiranyaka. So to feel pain when somebody is abusive with us is natural. In fact, the examples given, and I can't find it again, but the example is given as an analogy for the power of mantra. Because one can say, well, mantra is just some sound. It says, yes, but cruel words pierce the heart more than physical arrows. That's the power of sound. And we can sometimes remember somebody's cruel words for 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 100 years after they've said it. Burns our heart. Well, that's because we're a person. We're a living entity. We have feelings. Even Krishna has feelings. Your devotees have feelings. Not that they don't have any feelings. Srila Prabhupada wrote in some report about how aggrieved he was at the criticisms of his godbrothers. But that famous verse where Prabhupada says, my godbrothers only gave me compression and depression and repression. But the difference is whether or not one becomes disturbed in one's service. The issue is not, do I end up feeling some emotional distress? If you don't, you're not alive. If it's just like, oh, okay, okay, la-di-da, you know, people I just have 3 months working for just hit me in the face, so who cares? No, it's not so kind of a tough. But the issue is, do I go on in my duty? You know, the dogs bark and the caravan goes on. Do I just go in a corner and cry and say, well, everybody's criticizing me, what can I do? Or do I fight back? You know, well, they're like this and they're like that. What about this? And I'm the only one like that. How dare you say this about me? Don't you know that I'm like this? And let me pull up all the evidence for you. And let me talk about all the ways in which you're like this. That's what happened at the sacrifice of Daksha. Right? They were hurling insults back and forth. And there's a tendency to go there. I was just mostly an observer and slightly a participant in a discussion among very learned Vaishnavas about something about the nature of the soul. And it was on a level of truth-seeking, but it started to veer off into personal attacks. At which point the people who started the discussion very deftly stopped it. That tendency is there. So I understand equanimity of mind does not mean that my emotions cease to function. What it means is that my service is not affected, my service mood is not affected, my love for Krishna is not affected, my love for Guru is not affected, my faith is not affected, my compassion and my affection and my relationship with the person who criticizes me is not affected. My external relationship may be affected. You know, if someone's trying to kill me, I'm not going to just walk into their arms and say, kill me. I may have to distance myself practically from some people, but I don't lose my mood of friendship and care and concern for anybody. So that's how I understand equanimity of mind. A kind of a rustic example of this, on a little different platform, but it's still the same principle. When Arjuna sees the universal form, his relationship or friendship with Krishna is disturbed. When Mother Yasoda sees the universal form, her relationship of mother to Krishna is not disturbed. You know, when Vasudeva and Devaki understand Krishna's greatness, they become reverential. And when the residents of Vrindavan understand Krishna's greatness, when Krishna lives covered on hill, you know, when he saves Nanda from Varuna, it just makes them love Krishna more. You know, they just think, wow, I've really got an amazing friend here. I'm so glad Krishna's my friend. Look at what kind of friend I have. He lives covered on hill. Their essential feeling of friendship doesn't get disturbed at all. Wow, look at my son. He's the president of the United States. What a nice son I have. Oh, I love him so much. Not, oh, my son's the president. Oh, my. So in a similar way, when there's some disturbance, our essential relationship doesn't become disturbed. When our friends, our relatives, the other devotees criticize us, which they will, guaranteed. 100%. And guarantee that the people who will criticize us the most are the people that we're serving. Prabhupada says right here, the more responsibility we take, the more criticism we're going to get. Guarantee. You know, we like to joke that when you become a GBC, you get a free t-shirt that has a target on the front and the back. And just the way
the road can be a stressful place. Download the Road Stress Reliever from 76.com. We're on the driver's side.
It is. But that doesn't deter our faith. like it said about Subhadra, Rupa Goswami says that when Abhimanyu was killed, Abhimanyu was their only child, when he was killed practically in the presence of Lord Krishna, it didn't change the color of Subhadra's faith in her transcendental brother. So we see many, 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 many times that when a devotee works hard and gets criticized, doesn't get the kind of support and appreciation that they need, that they want, and instead gets criticized, they lose faith in the process. They stop chanting their dharams, they stop reading the books, they stop being enthused in their service. So that's why I was saying that if we want to be satisfied, what the whole essence of my class was, that if we want to be satisfied in our work, if we want that feeling that I am doing what I am meant to do, I am doing something that fits me, I am becoming, developing expertise in my service, and I am doing a service that has meaning. In order to be fixed in that, which is the only thing that can give us satisfaction, the only way we can get the supersedity is if our service to Krishna is unmotivated and uninterrupted. Is we got to have equanimity of mind. Otherwise, it's whenever these things happen, our service becomes interrupted, which shows that our service is motivated. It's motivated by the acclaim and the appreciation of other jivas, separate from Krishna. So that's the way in which we need to have equanimity. To have equanimity in the sense that I'm a stone, that's not true even for God.
Very good. That's doable.
Could I make a comment?
Doable, you know. One of the tricks that Maya has, she's really good at this, by the way, I've noticed in my own life, is that Maya convinces us that what Krishna consciousness is something other than what it really is. And the thing that Maya presents is something that's not doable. So Maya says, if you want to be a devotee, actually what you have to do is this. And that thing she's presenting is something that's impossible to do. Unnatural. And so then we think, oh, I guess I can't do Krishna consciousness. Maya's really good at putting the wrong thing in front of us and saying, oh, this is actually what you have. Okay, I can take one more question.
All right, Krishna. This is Madan Mohan. I had a comment that I remember Prabhupada once had a saying. He says, the one for whom I have stolen is calling me a thief. I thought that fit there. And also, I had a couple of ideas. There's this one American saying, fight fire with fire. I think that had to do with verbal assaults. And I had modified that slightly to say, fight fire with water, because there's a lot of that in our philosophy, samsara, dhava, to fight fire with water. And then there was one more that I kind of got from my mother about don't lower yourself to their standard. So if they criticize, you can become just like that. So I kind of called that catching a quality. Just like if someone has a cold, you may catch it if you associate with them, but someone else might not because of their immune system. So I was thinking the immune system in our Krishna consciousness for not catching a quality is satisfaction. Which is
very. I think that's very good. And you're talking about water. Of course, Prabhupada sometimes used the saying of fight fire with fire when Prabhupada was dealing with Mr. Nair in Bombay, who was trying to cheat the devotees. So Prabhupada said, all right, if he's going to be using these genius methods, so we may also get him like that. So the devotees did something like installing the deity in a tiny little brick building, because according to Indian law, once the deities are installed, then you can't use the deities. So they did things like that. But what Srila Prabhupada did not do is Srila Prabhupada did not criticize people by name in public forums.
Yeah.
He used to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes he made general indirect statements, like saying, you know, if Nixon was really the master of America, why could the people drag him down? But you will find Prabhupada making general critical statements about Mayavadis or about materialistic people. But if he said something about a particular person, it was in a private situation as something explanatory to illumine something and not to attack that person. And he never did public attacks on individuals. He just didn't do it.
Well, I was also thinking that Lord Prabhupada explained that one is if it's attack on you, and the other is if it's attack on the devotee or Krishna, that we respond differently. There's the Janadati for the self, but...
That's not true. Don't even find Prabhupada in defending Krishna, that he would shy away from naming people publicly. When it came to, you know... people preaching false philosophies. If you look carefully, Srila Prabhupada very rarely, almost never, named names. When he told the devotees not to, he told us, like in Back to Godhead, you shouldn't be naming names. I mean, you can get close enough so people can figure it out themselves, but that's a little different. You can talk about the people who are selling mantras and the people who are preaching, you know, we're all God. And Prabhupada would talk about people who would advertise, you know, 6 months of meditation, you can become God. And then one day I saw the posters of this one group that actually said, in 6 months of meditation, you can become God. You can become Krishna even. But I never heard Srila Prabhupada mention that group by name in a public place, although he would refer to them indirectly. So Prabhupada was very careful, even though Srila Prabhupada was criticized by name by some of these people. And what you say about water reminds me about what Jesus said about little drops of water wearing away stone. And Jesus talked about turning the other cheek, that if someone hits you on one cheek, you turn your other cheek, let them hit you on that cheek too. And if they take your coat, you voluntarily give them your shirt. Jesus said, return good for evil. So one of the, in fact, that's what Krishna does. Even if Krishna kills a demon, he liberates them. Krishna returns good for evil. So one of the most devastating things you can do to an enemy is kindness. Is not to reciprocate in kind. And sometimes you can't be kind to people directly. I mean, I have met persons who are so entrenched in their envy and anger that just can't deal with them with kindness in any way, shape, or form. But you can be kind to them from a distance. You can think kindly of them. Now, sometimes thinking kindly of a person may involve punishment of them. The king who thinks kindly of the citizens has to punish some of them. But it's not done out of false ego, out of anger. Without doing that, we're not really agents of Krishna, who is kind and loving to everyone. Although his kindness sometimes comes in the form of punishment, it sometimes comes in the form of keeping distant from them and not showing himself to them. It doesn't always come in some cushy, fuzzy form. In fact, I just recently went through an exercise with a few devotees that helped me quite a lot. There was one person who was writing and saying some things about me that were quite hurtful. And it was a person that I wasn't able to reason with. I mean, I could reason with them for about 20 or 30 seconds. And I would think I was getting somewhere, and then again, they'd become unreasonable. So I thought, all right, well, there's some things I can do. I can, you know, have their emails sent directly to my trash folder so I just won't see the stuff and not answer the phone if they call. That was pretty simple. But I was still dealing with the feeling of this person was my enemy. So I consulted with some other devotees and we went through a little exercise where we really meditated on how this person must feel. And by doing that, I got to have some empathy for that person, as another person. But this is another person just like me. Krishna talks about this in the sixth chapter. You see the happiness and distress of others in relation to your own self. That's a true yogi. So I can understand this is a person who has they have needs just like I do. And this person obviously has a lot of things in their life that just that aren't working, and a lot of pain. And this is how this person most likely feels, and therefore they're acting this way, and I got some empathy for them. And then I was able, which I couldn't do before, I was able to go to Krishna and say, please shower this person with your love. I was able to do that genuinely. By kind of getting into the other person's skin, so to speak. So I believe that those are some of the most powerful ways of being water to fire and turning good for evil. It doesn't mean on the external platform you talk to the person or you meet with them, or, but that your mood towards them. Just like I gave the example of Jed Barrett and Maharaj Rahukana. So Jed Barrett was, it said he felt waves of dissatisfaction within the mind from Maharaj Rahukana's insulting of him. He did not respond with insults. He did not do tit for tat, like Prabhupada talks about Maharaj Parikshit putting the snake around Shyamaka Rishi's neck, and he said this kind of, he calls that tit for tat silly. And he said, you know, generally someone of Maharaj Parikshit's stature, he does not do that kind of thing. So with Jed Barrett, even though he was disturbed, he could see that this king is receptive to hearing spiritual knowledge. And he could understand that this king was receptive to hearing spiritual knowledge from him. And he tried it a little. You know, he tested the water a little, and he started giving Maharaj Rahukana spiritual instruction. And Maharaj Rahukana very quickly said, yes, I want to hear from you. Be my guru. At which point, Jed Barrett was able to give very in-depth spiritual instruction. The point is that he responded to the verbal attack with compassion. So that's what I would say, fighting fire with water. Now, how exactly that compassion manifests, that depends on the particular situation. Okay, it's now 9 o'clock. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Jai, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.
All glories to the wonderful Jai.
Hare Krishna.